title of today's session is Loving Our Enemies in the Nuclear Age. And I want to start by handing out some surveys. And if you have pens or pencils, it's helpful. If you don't have to have them. And I don't even know that I have enough for everyone. So you might have to look on with someone else. At least, if not, fill them in. Okay, if so, turn to one or two other people, and why don't you talk about the one or two questions that you had the most difficulty answering? All right. By cutting off some good discussion, I hear all sorts of good things going on. But I hope to have, if I start with my presentation now, I hope to have plenty of time at the end to continue. Does anyone just want to share a sentence or two about what they shared in a small group, particularly about the latter question, what has shaped your opinions up until now? Just a sentence or two. What has it been that's shaped your attitudes? Anyone want to share that?
Well, you know, I've been going to Holden here for about 20 years.
Okay.
I go about every other year for a week. And so I think I got initial interest through sessions like this that have been held.
Okay, sessions at
Holden. And I go to peace conferences.
Okay. Others?
Fear and revulsion to violence and torture and things like that.
Okay.
Seeing what's happened to the Vietnam veterans years later.
Vietnam veterans? Okay.
Yeah, the respect for human life that I was taught as a child by my father, who was a minister, and then that went into the 60s and we saw what was happening, and that really made a place then for my thinking.
Okay, all right.
Besides my personal convictions, League of Women Voters has some very good information.
League of Women Voters, okay.
I come from three generations of pacifists, which means men in my family had to go to jail in order not to go to war and stuff. So it was an honorable heritage.
My convictions come from firsthand knowledge of military and being in military families.
Okay.
And I would say that military people and their families are the last people in the world who want to go to war, because a war would directly affect them.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean they're not willing.
All right. Thank you.
I was in the military for 7 years, and as a physician, I saw problems within the military that we don't see, that civilians often don't see. And I had a feeling when I came to Holden 5 years ago that I was on the fence. I wasn't one side or the other. And since I joined a group of physicians called Physicians for Social Responsibility, I've really become involved, and I attended just earlier this month at international conference in Budapest, which was a real stimulating conference.
Okay. Couple more, one, two.
During the 60s and the Vietnam situation, I somehow became what I would call a world citizen. And that has really shaped my thinking, my attitudes and actions since then.
Thanks.
I was an aerospace engineer for 12 years. And I could sort of see the waste, both in a big company and in the military that we dealt with, you know. And, you know, it was very easy to overbuild things just because people benefited financially with their careers. And, you know, I think we way overbuilt our needs.
Okay. Well, thanks for sharing that. It gives me a good sense. And I think that's, I start that way because I think it's a very important question to ask when talking about questions of war and peace. It's important to know where we're coming from. I've come to see that that's particularly important in my work, because these days it seems that there are all sorts of people now talking about war and peace. That may not have been true years and years ago, but it is definitely true now. All sorts of people talking about peace. My organization, Eastern Peace Fellowship, Ronald Reagan talks about peace, the Soviet Union talks about peace, the media is talking about war and peace. Where I come from, in Minneapolis, the Honeywell Corporation, which is a weapons producer, has all sorts of forums about peace and peacemaking. So it comes from all different sides. And I am strongly convinced that in an age when peace is talked about so much, that we begin to lose sight of what that word really means, and it's important to know where we're coming from. I had one experience a couple years ago. I had the opportunity to travel to Eastern Europe and some Soviet Union bloc countries, and also in East and West Germany. And a group of 20 Lutherans, I was in a bus in East Berlin and riding along the Berlin Wall, and our East German tour guide was telling us, now on our right is the Great Wall of Peace. And a few of us in the back of the bus started chuckling to each other, you know, how could she ever call this a wall of peace, something that divides people? And then we looked at, you know, the barbed wire for peace and the soldier with the machine gun for peace, and we just said, you know, what an abuse of that word. And we were laughing about this among ourselves until we realized that it sounds an awful lot like Ronald Reagan calling the MX missile a peacekeeper. And our realization that it's really on both sides that that word becomes abused. And I'm convinced that when peace is talked about so much, it becomes a slippery word, and it then becomes important for us to get beyond that word and talk about our particular style of peacemaking. And that's what I want to get at, is not only talking about peace, but what is our particular style as Christians when we approach peacemaking. I'll share a little bit with you what I found in my experiences, which has been primarily within the Lutheran community. And I found it disturbing that I don't see Christians sitting down together and talking about the arms race as Christians very often. I think that we sit down and talk about it most often as Republicans and Democrats, as liberals and conservatives. We talk about it in terms of the Russian threat, or perhaps out of concern for the sake of our families or even our style of life. But rarely do we sit down together and talk about questions of war and peace as the basis, on the basis of our faith in Jesus Christ as we know him in the Gospels. And I think that that shapes the kinds of questions that we tend to ask then about the arms race. And the questions that I hear most often are, for instance, what about the Russians? How much is enough deterrence? Will Star Wars work? Can we afford to let down our defenses? What would happen in a nuclear war? What would it be like to live under a Soviet system? Those are the kinds of questions that are asked. And as important as those questions are, and I really do think they're important, I don't think that they stem from the roots of our Christian faith. I think they come out of other contexts, either from a fear that we may have, or they come perhaps out of practical considerations that have to do with our own survival or the survival of our family and friends. But I do think that our questions about war and peace can stem from our belief in Jesus Christ. They can be centered in Jesus Christ as we know him in the gospel. And it's important here, I think, at Holden Village, where we're gathered in Christian community, to go back and ask some basic questions based on our Christian faith. And the one that I want to center on this morning is, how ought we, as followers of Jesus Christ, to love our enemies today in the nuclear age? I think it's not the only question, but I think it's a very important one. I think it's important for us to spend time together talking about the arms race, not only as a national security issue, not only as a public policy question, but as a spiritual issue that directly affects the life of the church. And for us to realize that everything that we say or don't say about the arms race affects the life of the church and in our faith in Jesus Christ. Let me share a little bit about what I mean by when I say that it's a spiritual issue. And I'll share a little bit of my journey. I grew up all my life as a Lutheran, first in the Missouri Synod, then in the AELC. Now I'm ALC, and many of my friends are LCA, and I work for a pan-Lutheran organization, so I feel like I have some sense of where Lutherans are at. But like many of you, I did not learn as a child, growing up in the church, I did not learn very much about what my church had to say about peace. That was just not part of my Christian education. What I heard, I think that I heard some inconsistencies, at least in Lutheran theology as it was taught to me, and I'll see if this jives with your experience. It seems that in the Lutheran Church we are very good at saying that for our personal salvation, God does everything and that we do nothing. Has anyone ever heard that in the Lutheran Church, that we are justified by grace through faith? Has anyone ever, is that just me or, okay, I'm getting some nods. But when it comes to human history, we seem to think that we do all and that God does nothing. You understand that inconsistency or that split? When it comes to God saves our soul, but somehow we save everything else, our bodies, our will. And now the church has been, now we in the church have come to believe that the only way that we can save ourselves, our bodies, or our church, or our nation, or our world, the only way we can save ourselves is through weapons of great destruction. And the result of this belief that somehow we can save ourselves is that we now find ourselves armed to the teeth, threatening to destroy the very world that we want to save. I've put this map up here. I hope you can all see it. Just to give a sense of how this has gotten so out of control, this belief that somehow we can save ourselves. I think it shows the demonic nature of the arms race today. Have people seen this before? Some of you have. The dot in the center represents all of the firepower available in the world at the end of World War II, or all that was used during World War II. It was 3 megatons, or 3 million tons of TNT. That includes Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Each of the other dots also represents 3 megatons. And altogether, it represents what's available right now in the world. Let's see. There's a little circle around 3 dots up here in the corner. That represents the firepower available in one Poseidon submarine. And down here in this corner represents the all the firepower available in one Trident submarine. And what they don't have on this map is usually there's a circle about as big as one of these squares that represents all the firepower that it would take to blow up every medium and large-sized city in the world. And I think this just gives a sense of the demonic nature of the arms race and how out of control it's become. And of course, we never, none of us want to see these weapons used. But we all know that nearly every arms race has ended in war, and now we begin to hear our leaders talk not only about deterrence, but about tactical nuclear warfare and first strike capability, counterforce, winability, survivability, integrated battlefields, those type of things, and that becomes very scary to us. And none of us want this to happen. We're not very happy about it, but we feel we need these weapons because somehow we feel our national self-interest is being threatened, or our lifestyle, or our ideology is being threatened. And because of our fear, we've been pulled along now following this out-of-control system that has gone completely out of control. I read an article a few months ago by Henry Nouwen that I thought was very helpful. It talked about this kind of fear that we have. He said, "We need more than ever now to hear the words, 'Fear not,' from the Gospels, because most of us are dominated by such a sense of fear." And he says that in itself is a scary thing, because when you think about it, people who make us fear are the ones who have the most control over us. When you think about it, I think you'll find that that's true. People who make us fear are the ones who have most control over us. As long as someone can make you fear, they can also convince you to buy into a system or a product that will relieve yourself of that fear. We will do almost anything to rid ourselves of fear or protect ourselves from a threat. And I think this is what's happened to us in terms of the arms races. We now base most all of our decisions on fear. And we've bought into a system that tells us to fear for our lives, and that the only way that we can save ourselves is not through the grace of God, but through weapons of mass destruction. And we put such faith in that system that it's gone completely out of control, and now it's become almost like our idol. And I don't use that word lightly. I don't think it should be used lightly, that word idolatry that we use in the church, which means, our definition of that would mean an idol is something which demands a huge sacrifice which its worshipers willingly give away. Something that demands an immense sacrifice which we willingly give away. And when we think about it, what do we sacrifice to the arms race? First of all, we sacrifice our money. It will be $2 trillion in the next 5 years that we spend building up our armaments. And now it's over 63% of our tax dollar goes to support past, pay for past wars and to support present war preparation efforts. We sacrifice lives. Our government is now telling us that 20 million lives would be an acceptable limit in, quote, winning a nuclear war. It's not only future wars, but past wars. A couple of people mentioned Vietnam. I went to the Vietnam Memorial a few months ago for the first time. And I know some of the rest of you have probably seen that too, and it's very moving. Something that was considered a relatively small war, the cost involved. I was there on Father's Day, and all the cards were out and for the fathers, and it was just an incredible sense of loss. And now to read that 55,000 soldiers in Vietnam died, and since Vietnam, more than 55,000 veterans have committed suicide. So more people have died since the Vietnam War by suicide. And now one-third of our U.S. prison population is Vietnam War-era veterans. One-third of our prison population. We not only sacrifice soldiers, but we sacrifice many of God's children who are poor and hungry around the world. There are experts that have figured out what we could do with just a fraction of what we spend each year on the arms budget. You know, safe water and education and global assistance to farmers and all of those things that could be solved. Not to say that we can solve all our problems with money, but if we redirected just a portion of what we spend on the military, all of the problems that could be solved. We also sacrifice the lives of people in our own country. All of the budget cuts in the last years, money that has been redirected directly to military spending. We sacrifice our economy, inflation. At least part of inflation is due in large part to weapons expenditures, and we sacrifice jobs. If we spend $1 billion, we could provide many, many more jobs through education and healthcare services than we do through the military. But most of all, I think what we sacrifice is the souls. We sacrifice our souls and the souls of our children, because what we are telling ourselves and our children is that we believe in the power of violence to solve problems, and we bought into a system that is designed to destroy other people just in order to save ourselves, our ideology, and our own standard of living. And I believe that the faith in this system has to be named for what it really is, and I think it's the chief sign of rebelliousness and sinfulness against God in our age. And it's not only a national security issue, it's not only a public policy issue, but it's a spiritual issue, because it has become our idol. And it's an issue of faith and trust, and something that the church needs to struggle with, because it presents us with a spiritual crisis. Because I think we have to ask ourselves now, can we continue to let all of this happen day after day and still go to church and pray that, say that we are God's children, we belong to the Lord, and that we put our trust in Jesus Christ? Or can we still sing that song last night that we sang, that Herman led us in, God's got the whole world in loving hands? Can we continue to sing that when we let all of this happen? I'm not so sure. I think that presents us with a spiritual crisis in the church. It seems to me that Jesus came in the world to provide an alternative, another way of living, and Jesus came into the world, into a violent world, to do that. I don't think that we can get away with saying that somehow Jesus is irrelevant today because he didn't know human sinfulness. Jesus came into a sinful world where violence was the reality, just like it is today. I think we need sometimes to go back and read what a violent time that was for the people of Israel and what oppression they were under when Jesus came into the world. He knew what we were capable of. He knew of the law of equal retaliation, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, or you hit me, I'll hit you, or you bomb Pearl Harbor and we'll obliterate Hiroshima and Nagasaki, or you build SS-20 missiles and we'll build cruise and Pershing missiles. He knew all about that. Or the concept of limited love. love your neighbor but hate your enemy. Be a patriotic American, but be prepared to fight those Russians. It seems that Jesus came to give another word. I say to you, love your enemy, bless those who persecute you, so you may be children of your Father who is in heaven. No longer are we to return as much violence as is shown to us. No longer are we to worry about having at our disposal as much destructive power as our adversary. No longer are we to only love those who love us back. Neighbor love now expands beyond the limited circle of those who we know. Now every person is, every person everywhere is to be loved by Jesus' followers. Everyone is a neighbor of Jesus's. And in that day, I think we have to understand that that included the Russian the Roman oppressors in that day. And for us, I think it includes the people of Russia that we are told to despise. Jesus' enemies are met with an entirely different response, with self-giving love, by accepting suffering rather than inflicting it. I want to read just a paragraph from written by a woman in West Germany. John Poulton, in his book Feast of Life, writes about, shares this quotation from a woman who's reacting to militarism today and reflecting on what Jesus had to say. Jesus lived without protection. That is not a statement of faith, just a plain observation. He renounced the protection a family offers. He did not want the protection afforded by property. He did not use protection of rhetoric, but remained silent. He expressly rejected the protection of weapons and armies. When Peter wished to defend him against being taken prisoner, he said, "Put your sword back into its place, for all who take the sword will perish by the sword." Christ reveals God as love that offers itself. God has no desire to keep himself protected and unapproachable. God practices no violence. God has disarmed himself in Jesus Christ unilaterally. I really like that a lot. God has disarmed himself in Jesus Christ unilaterally. And I think it's in the cross of Jesus that we most completely see how God deals with God's enemies. Not by destroying them, but by showering them with an abundance of love. And Paul writes that so clearly in Romans, one of my favorite passages. God showed his love for us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. While we were enemies, we were reconciled to God by the death of his Son. In other words, while we were God's enemies, God overcame us through love. And to me, that was an earth-shattering moment when I began to understand, to see myself as someone else's enemy. That being someone else's enemy is part of our human condition. And that in God's eyes, no one of us is better than anyone else. I forget who used to say it, Clarence Jordan or somebody like that used to say, we're all bastards, but God loves us anyway. And I think when we begin to understand that, we begin to understand the radical nature of the gospel and the kind of love that God has shown us. But what does it mean now when we hear that we're supposed to love as God loved us? That kind of self-giving, nonviolent love, that kind of disarmed life that was shown to us in the cross of Jesus, now that kind of love sets the norm for all of our behavior if we're to be followers of Jesus Christ. We're called to pick up our cross and to follow him. Before Easter, that kind of life seemed impossible, even to disciples like Peter. But the resurrection and Pentecost removed all doubt that love is the most powerful force on earth. And Jesus' way of dealing with enemies is now a present possibility. And so now we have to ask ourselves, what does that mean for us as the church, those who are followers of Jesus, that community gathered together that desires to be present in the world the way Jesus was present? What does that mean for us to live that kind of life? How do we live the disarmed life in a world that's armed to the teeth? That's a question I want for us to center on now in our discussion. It seems to me that the question at stake is whether the church will announce to whom it belongs. Do we live under the sign of the cross, or do we live under the sign of the bomb? Are we a church that accommodates itself to business as usual, which is the business of preparing, making preparations for war, Or are we the body of Christ that lives and gives itself up for the life of the world? And might that even mean giving ourselves up for the life of our enemies? I think those are the questions sometimes that we need to start asking as church, as people of God. And so now I would just open it up and ask a couple things. One, first I want to make clear that I always assume that there are people who are working in military installations, families of military. I always assume that, and I want to make sure people know that I'm not talking about individual people working in individual places, but I'm talking about us being a part of a system that's gone out of control, and we're all connected to that. That's the first thing. And the second thing is, I would like for us to talk as Christians about the arms race. And I think that's very difficult for every time that I've tried to do this, it has not turned out very well, because we always slide back into the questions of effectiveness or how do we protect ourselves. I would like for us to center on, what does it mean to be followers of Christ today in the nuclear age? And maybe one of the questions that we can ask is, how do you see the body of Christ, in this case maybe the Lutheran Church, how do you see us beginning to live that kind of life today? How do you see us beginning to be followers of Jesus in the world today? I saw a couple hands, and I'll just open it up now. We have a good 20, 25 minutes.
Okay, I enjoyed your initial presentation, and it shed some light. I guess the question I would like to bring up then, and in trying to identify what is the basic question that we have to answer, and you didn't deal with so much the idea of atomic weapons or that in my estimation. It was more a question of how does a Christian respond in the world today. From a military aspect or from a purely Christian aspect. So my question then is, from a purely Christian standpoint, in the philosophy that you would suggest, is there any rationalization for military involvement? Is there any type of situation that would provide a justification for a war? Or for us to involve ourselves militarily, regardless of the terrible implications of the atomic situation, and to further ask that, you know, what looking at the terrible hardships that some other people might be enduring, in the case of World War II, the Jews and the Cambodian people that we find out about, do any of those things, the terrible things that are happening, would that be justification enough to involve ourselves militarily, or should we take a purely Christian standpoint and turn the other cheek, and how can we respond otherwise? I guess that's, to me, I can't quite get where you're at. You know, okay. Is there any severe circumstance? You know, if my son was being persecuted in a place where his life was threatened, and I had a choice to militarily go in and try to salvage that life, I guess I would feel that, at this point I would probably do so.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's very helpful. I think, first of all, the question is, do we understand what Jesus was about? And do we see Jesus as a figure of nonviolence? I think once we see that, then the question is, are we called to follow Jesus? And can we do that in a simple world? Or are we called to do that in a simple world? Or are there times when we're called not to follow Jesus? Or we're called to live another way in certain situations and to use violence? And those are tough questions, but I think those are the kinds of questions that we have to begin asking. Now, if we, one thing that we can do is take a look at what at least the mainline churches have said since the 4th century, is that Jesus's Sermon on the Mount, the ethic of Jesus, is the norm for all of us, for all of our life, and all of our behavior. There may be rare instances in which violence is a last resort, and there's a whole set of criteria which the church has come up with as not has not brought them from the Gospels, but has created a set of criteria in which violence would be justifiable. It's called the Just War Criteria. It was created by, well, Augustine gets the most credit for it, but it comes from far back as Plato and Cicero. And does anyone know that criteria? Can anyone share one or two of them?
I think one point is that non-combatants, people who are not involved in the war, must not be injured.
Non-combatants have to be are immune. They should not be targeted. Any others? Can anyone remember any of them? Has anyone ever heard of the Just War Criteria before? There's some nods. Yeah.
Very good. Must. Good.
Proportionality. The good that is to come out of it has to outweigh the destruction that is done. Okay, that's the law of proportionality. The others are, it has to be a last resort. All nonviolent means of conflict resolution have to be exhausted first. It has to be a just cause. In other words, it cannot be simply retribution. It cannot be an aggressive first strike attack. It has to be completely defensive. Other people can help me. I don't have my notes here.
Legal procedures must be
followed. It has to be legally declared by a legitimate authority. War cannot be waged if it looks like it will mean suicide for a nation, because suicide is against the will of God for an individual as for a nation. I think that was six of them. The seventh would be that the defeated have to be shown mercy at the end of a war. That at the end of the war you cease the hostilities and you help rebuild up what has been destroyed. But all those criteria have to be met in order for a war to be justifiable. Now that's the criteria that the Church has brought from the fourth century, which is different from an absolute ethic of following Jesus in all situations. But in a nuclear age, I make the case that those two come pretty close together. That it would be very hard, if not impossible, to satisfy those seven criteria in modern warfare. So I try to make the point in my work with Lutheran Peace Fellowship is whether you hold to the just war criteria that our church holds to in the Augsburg Confession, or whether you follow Jesus at every step along the way, I think those two come together and bring us to a common conclusion that we need to begin opposing war today on the basis of our faith. Yeah.
I'm not violent or anything, but Jesus wasn't peaceful all the time. There were times when he lost his cool.
Oh, yeah. I think he became angry, and I think that we are not very good at even imagining what a disruption he would have caused. But in terms of using violence, there's no evidence that he used violence towards any person. He probably used a whip on an animal, as someone would do in that day, but certainly would not have killed anyone, and certainly is no justification there for violence on our part. But he certainly did get angry and upset things. But in terms of, I assume you're referring to driving out of the temple, that most certainly was his moral authority that would have got angry at his disciples. Yeah, I'm not talking necessarily about anger, but the respect for human life, and particularly the taking of one's life. Yeah,
I think it's very important In trying to love our enemies, that we get to know them. And I'm really impressed with little glimpses here and there of what I hear about exchange programs, in particular between the USA and the USSR. Do you know, let's say that I wanted to go to Russia to meet Russian people as they are and to have them meet me as I am. Do you know how I could do that?
Yeah, I think that's very possible. Maybe we can talk about that afterwards. I would like to stay on the issue of loving our enemies and what Christ demands of us. But yeah, that is possible, and there are ways in which there can be exchanges, and that happens.
I think it's very important.
Oh, yeah.
What we don't know, we tend to be afraid of. And what we do know, I think it would be easier for us to lower him.
And one of the ways the church can play a strong role, especially the Lutheran Church, which is, with its contacts in Eastern Europe, is play a part in humanizing people who have become dehumanized by our government, people that we are told to not trust. We should be in the lead in exchanging and building up that level of trust.
You know, I think we almost have to, you know, addressing, as we as Christians, I mean, serious about the peace and nonviolence, it strikes me we almost have to work outside the church. Because there is such an unholy alliance between the church and the government in this country. It's kind of subtle and behind the scenes, and it isn't just my observation. I'm just reading a biography of Pope John Paul II, and he's asked me, and he sees that as a great weakness of the Protestant and the Catholic Church in this country. You know, because we have this tax exemption and all these other things that, you know, and I think you almost, you know, I'm only thinking now kind of off the top of my head, but almost like you'd have to start with some kind of peace fellowship thing and get people interested and build the thing up and not spend a lot of time trying to change the church hierarchy and all the people that are in it, because they've got vested reasons to keep it like it is. And so many people want it the way it is. Mm-hmm. They believe in violence and, you know, why not take a small move? You know, just, that's the response that kind of comes to me. You just get serious about building up such things as a peace organization and mm-hmm. understanding nonviolence.
Well, I feel very strongly that it has to begin within the church. And maybe it won't start with bishops and presidents of churches, but it can start on the congregational level and Christian communities. I do want to share with you at some point this book called Conversion that talks about how the churches need to be converted. This book was held up at a meeting of over 200 top brass in the Pentagon a couple of years ago. And one of the chief leaders of the Pentagon held it up and said, everything that is a threat to us right now resides within the churches. And if you want to read the most articulate argument for the other side, read this book, The Call to Conversion by Jim Wallis. It talks about how the church itself can become converted back to a Christianity that we've really lost. And I trust the Pentagon. It has the largest peace library in the world, and I think they know what they're talking about when they mention a book like this. So this is in the bookstore. There's a hand back there first and then up here.
When you're talking about letting our people, I think something that can come through really good is to become more lovable to our enemies, that we're not as despicable. And I think one thing that I know I always struggle with is how much wealth we have. And it has, I think if I lived in a poor nation, I would be pretty jealous of most Americans and the wealth that we have. And I think it's a real challenge as individuals and as members of the church to deal with that wealth in a more responsible way, to try really hard to live lighter, and with that extra money do something important for poor world peace. And that means a daily challenge. Today I was in the bookstore. Do I buy a t-shirt? Do I buy some books I can share with friends on living more peacefully and raising children more peacefully? And it is not easy. Every little detail, every choice we make is tough. Mm-hmm. Are you going to buy bananas that were raised by somebody who didn't get to eat one because they're not an American, stuff at 30 cents a pound? Or are you going to pick up a free apple from the ground? Mm-hmm. It's really tough. It's a tough moment-to-moment decision-making process.
And to remember that there is no guiltless place to stand, but we're always guilty, but we try to put our life in line with what we at least say we're about, and that's not an effort. Eating apples from the ground isn't an effort for us to be guiltless, but that we try in every way that we can to live justly and to work for peace. And that involves, like you say, every part of our life, from our lifestyle to the kinds of things we invest in, to vocational responsibility, responsibility for where our tax money goes, writing to our congresspeople. You know, there are all sorts of ways in which we can live that out. That's helpful.
Do you know anything about something that's called the Shape of Town Pledge?
Yeah, that's very helpful. I forget what book it's in. You might be able to tell people.
A book called No More Plastic Jesus.
Maybe in the bookstore.
It's
Oh, it's not, okay.
Good.
Okay, yeah.
One of the problems I see is in a group like this, we're trying to discuss logically a very illogical thing, to love our enemies.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus came into the world very illogically. We don't understand his preaching because we think in the Greek form of logics.
Mm-hmm.
We think there's got to be a solution to the problem. We work on it. We think about it. We try and form a concrete solution to enemies and how do we love an enemy without getting blown up. And I've fought with this, and I have very good feelings about a particular group in Victoria, British Columbia. They're a college of Chinese studies. We can learn from the very ancient studies, and I'll just read this very short quote from someone like Aristotle, a fellow by the name of Lao Tzu in China. He lived 300 years before Aristotle lived. And this, just think about it as I read it. Having and not having arise together. Difficult and easy complement each other. Long and short contrast each other. High and low rest upon each other. Voice and sound harmonize each other. The 10,000 things carry yin and embrace yang. They achieve harmony by combining these forces. Opposites, end quote. Opposites, therefore, are not considered as hostile or antagonistic, but as complementary and necessary. Without the opposites, there will be no unification into harmony. The existence of one opposite depends on the existence and welfare of the other. No single opposite can afford to exist in isolation. Such a dialectic unites and does not divide. The ultimate end is harmony. And I try and think that's what Jesus came into the world to say. We love our enemies. Our enemies are not unlike us. They're different than us. They hate us. We hate them. But we love them. We live with them. We allow them like they allow us to live. The Soviets allow us to live by not pushing the button. We allow them to live by not pushing our button. The point is, we can live together in one world in harmony. We don't have to live in antagonism. And that's what Jesus was bringing in, the embodiment of harmony.
Okay. What if at some point that begins to not make sense? For instance, the Russians really do seem to be a threat to what we are about. And let's say that the other side doesn't play the same rules that we do.
Well,
what is our response? I mean, what does the Christian faith then call us to? I always say that we're all pacifists in between wars, but that's a little bit like being vegetarians in between meals. You know, when push comes to shove, violence is the solution to our problems. And I think you're right on when you say that it's irrational. Jesus will be a stumbling block to us, but I feel that our commitment to peace has to be so firmly rooted in that faith, and it is faith. It's not. I don't want to add up all the statistics that says that the arms race is foolish. I think that ought to be based in what we believe in Jesus Christ. And you're right, it's not rational, but it's a faith. And the whole thing would crumble if we didn't believe in Jesus Christ, our whole commitment to nonviolence.
Well, I agree with that. All I was saying was that it's illogical to try and solve with logic. How do we become loving our enemies? That's all I'm saying. Mm-hmm. You can sit down and think about it. How do we do it? And if the other side doesn't do it, it doesn't work out. Like you're saying, there's illogical things going on here. And I'm just saying, if we can agree to disagree. In other words, we can agree to have different viewpoints mm-hmm. about the world and how the world should be run. And we can agree that they have their own right to live, we have our own right to live, and we can agree to that.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying mm-hmm. one has to win over the other. That's Greek thinking.
Mm-hmm. Come on. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. I think it's probably idealistic to think we're going to be in a world where we're not going to have conflict or where there's going to be differences of interest no matter how ideal the world is. There are going to be these pressures and so on. It seems to me most helpful to this business of balance and so on. It's shown that it's helpful. And there's a story that's just a marvelous one. It's a true story that a nun told about what happened in her convent or whatever one place. And there were a couple of nuns there who had grown up in comparatively sheltered life, and then they came to the convent and they lived there in a very sheltered way for decades. But it came their turn to represent that particular local group in the convention of the order in New York City. So the person in charge there of the convent oriented them so that they could know what to expect when they got to the city. So they said, well, there were going to be people of different colors and people speaking different languages and so on. That was one thing. And the other thing is, there's a high crime rate, so always go in groups, don't go alone. So they got to the to New York, checked into the hotel, went up to their room on the 12th floor, got into the elevator to come down, and the elevator stopped on the 7th floor. And the doors opened, and a big, burly black man was there, and he had two guard dogs, one on each hand, and they were just terrified. Everything they'd been warned about was coming true. Here they were trapped in the elevator and couldn't do anything about it. And he strode onto the elevator just shook as they got in. And oh, they were terrified. The man then was settling in, there was the elevator down. So he said to his dog, sit! And the nuns were so nervous that they both squatted down. he had dark glasses on. That was the other thing we had done. So Ronald took off his glasses, and he was Reggie Jackson. And he was embarrassed because the nuns were embarrassed. So he insisted on paying for their hotel rent for the rest of the time that they were there. But it's a wonderful story that illustrates how we exaggerate our enemy. We get these images in our minds, and then the enemy becomes way out of proportion. I mean, there is an element of realism in the world where we have different interests and so on, and to say, well, we like everybody that's around is kind of unrealistic. But the real thing as Christians is trying to understand it in proportion, to see exactly what the nature of that is, so it doesn't become so much larger than life, because then we make that person more of an enemy, and then that person makes us more of an enemy, and so the whole thing kind of grows to proportions that get to be unmanageable. And if we can somehow unhook that spiral, that seems to me to be the role of the Christians, to look at it for what it is. And, you know.
What are the implications for that kind of a viewpoint for the church itself? I'm not sure if we all realize the extent to which the church, as much as any part of society, is involved in the arms race. All of us, in many ways. For instance, the LCA has come out with a statement opposing first strike weapons, but we have over $6 million invested, in our pension board invested in aerospace corporations that produce first strike weapons. There is one solid way in which we are saying something else other than love your enemies, or we allow military recruiters sometimes into our youth conventions to talk to our children about war. There are our bishops are sometimes the ones who oppose strong language that talk about possession of nuclear weapons. All of us probably pay 3 to 4 to 5 times as much to the military through our tax dollars than we do for building up the church. There are all sorts of ways in which our actions say that we are more concerned about protecting ourselves, our own style of life, than we are about loving our enemies. And I'm wondering, what does it take for the church to somehow say something different?
There are a few people at Northfield Theological Meeting of Friends, which is actually arranged with the IRS to have a portion of their taxes that goes to actual weapons. I don't know if it's the whole defense part of it, go to peacekeepers. Mm. And it took a long time. It's a man who's written a book called Waging Peace, which was published by Barclay Press, which is the Friends publisher, which tells me of Oregon. But it took him years and more red tape than anyone would ever care to discuss. But his family and several other families are actually able to do that. And they send off, I think they should have to action periodically. But they were able to do it through the system, which is very important to them, rather than a protest in keeping back the tax.
So It's one way in which we, through the community of faith, try to say something different. Are there other ways?
Like to inform us, you know, like I work with the adult education in our church and the programs that are put on, you know, and to actually get much more serious about the programs, because I kind of don't present too many of these programs, because when we present one of these, a strong on a peace issue or something, not as many people attend, and in fact some people get angry at having them presented. But you know, we could just say, okay, you know, there's going to be fewer there, but we're going to be more serious about finding out exactly what Jesus teaches on this matter and what our responsibilities are, and not worrying about being popular particularly, and you know, take some of the guff that comes with it.
Thank you.
We have to go to the audience.
Okay. Go ahead.
I think probably the way to start would be just basically with our own families and the friends around us, because I know I get real uptight if my friends say, well, this is what you should do, or this is really a good whole thing to do, and I don't happen to agree with that. And then I'll start with a war between us, and we'll get angry at each other, and we'll curl up towards, instead of saying, well, okay, I'll listen to your point of view and you listen to my point of view, where, you know, what are the strengths of both, and then agreeing that we disagree and still being friends at the end of that. And we do that with our children, you know, we're not doing what exactly what we want, so we go. Adam or say, no, you can't do it this way.
I think parenting for peace is one of the most important ways that we can begin to teach our children how to live that kind of nonviolent lifestyle in every situation. I think that's very important. Sometimes we often think that it's only the people out there protesting are the ones who are the peacemakers, and I think it's in many different areas of life, including parenting, quietly teaching children how to be God's reconciling agents. Any other comments or questions? I can't get a sense. Has this left you confused or angry or disagreeing or helpful, excited? I can't sense it. Does anyone want to, in the last couple minutes?
See, I think it's kind of helpful to me. The more I learn about these different things, in other words, it's apparent to me that I've got to learn more what Jesus' style really was and take it more seriously. And it is hard. The matter of my enemies, too. I had two chances to be in China. Once was in June and once was in 82. Well, then I find when I go over there, only 4% of that country, and that's the largest communist country in the world, over a billion people, but only 4% are in the Communist Party, so how can I be upset with them? And then I find out there's 2 or 3 or more million Christians, you know, sort of underground over there, and they're allowing a church to open up. You know, so it makes it much more complicated. It isn't they.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how could I get, so my enemies over there are reduced from, you know, even if I'm concerned about communist members themselves, and then I get to know some of them actually when I was over there.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're really trying to do is help others is one of the main things that, you know, maybe it's lip service, but they accuse me of the same thing in my Christian faith.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's hard to find your enemies.
I have a housemate who often travels to Central America and leads study trips down there, and he was in Nicaragua a couple of months ago and said the first time that the parable of the Good Samaritan ever really hit home to him was when it was told by a peasant in Nicaragua who told the story of the good Marxist-Leninist.
Mm-hmm.
And to begin to see that someone who we name as enemy is not only a neighbor, but is a helpful neighbor and can be helpful sometimes to other people. And it begins to break down some walls. Doesn't mean that we approve of every policy of our adversary, but begin to understand who other people are, especially in the Soviet Union. I think that's so important that, and you said it, when we aim our weapons at that country, we're aiming them at our own body, if we are the body of Christ. There are 40 to 60 million Christians in the Soviet Union, 1 to 2 million Lutherans, 1 million just in Siberia. And the church is growing. estimated that 20% of the population of the Soviet Union is in church on Sundays. And those are the people that we are now called to name as enemy.
I make one quick comment about the conference I attended. There were over 1,000 people attended an international congress. It's called the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. And they came from 40 countries. One third of them were communists. One third of the delegates were from North America, which included USA, Canada. Another third were either non-aligned, neutral, or somewhat toward democracy or communism. And there was, to think of gathering that number of people together, and they've done this for 5 years, not one bit of discontent in that whole conference of 4 days was amazing. These people were all there for one reason, and that was to look into the solutions to prevent nuclear war. And I think that's an optimistic thing for me to see, that all these nations attending an international conference that can get together, go through some very scary stuff in conferences and symposia, and come away with an optimistic feeling. It was really super. So I wanted to sort of Thanks. Tell you that it was an excellent feeling for me to come out of that.
Thanks for sharing that. So before we quit, I think either the bell is going to ring shortly or it has rung. I just want to share one book that is in the bookstore called By Faith Alone, A Lutheran Looks at the Bomb. And this was written by the Holland Village Resource Center director, Dan Erlander, who lived here for the past 3 years and just left this spring. This is a good theological look at the arms race from a Lutheran perspective. It's very easy to read, and it's good for congregational use.